Don't you step inside this bus! Don't you even step inside this bus!
Dorset police block a main road to keep New Age travellers out of a seaside resort.
This is my home, and I'm gonna protect it!
It's just one of hundreds of confrontations that'll take place this summer as a growing band of nomads takes to Britain's roads.
Tonight, Weldon Action uncovers the sinister world of Combat 18. Late last year, people all over England began getting death threats. Some claim to be from the Ku Klux Klan.
We have got your location and where you live, and we'll be watching you, and we're going to take you out. It's as simple as that. You're nothing but a Jewish slag. You'll be taken out by the Ku Klux Klan.
Just let her know the Combat 18 have got her eye on her. We're going to take her out.
In a picturesque corner of Norfolk, Alison Loughlin runs a guest house. It's a retreat for people wanting a break from city life. Last year, she donated a weekend here as a prize in a raffle for the anti-apartheid movement. This innocent gesture led to a frightening telephone encounter.
He said, have you ever had anyone from the anti-apartheid movement? And I said, yes, I have. I was happy to receive some people who'd won the raffle prize. I said, in what connection do you ask? And he said, oh, well, we've heard that you had those people and we don't like that and we're going to make... And I said, well, I'm not sure that you've really got the right impression about this. And he said, oh, yes, we've certainly got the impression about what you're doing. And we don't like it and we're going to be making a very nasty impression on you. And I said, well, you know, can you just tell me who I'm talking to? He said, it's a member of the British Ku Klux Klan.
Another victim was Cheshire holiday operator Martin Vasey. Like Alison Loughlin, his generosity had made him a target.
We received a call that came on our answer phone one Friday night, a person describing himself as from the British Ku Klux Klan. He said that it had come to his notice that we'd offered a prize to the anti-apartheid movement for a fun run that they were doing down in London. And he said as a result of that, he wasn't very happy about it and the offices would be attacked. We wondered whether it was a bit of a prank, a bit of a joke, but it was true that we had given this prize, so the person obviously knew about that, and we took it seriously enough to contact the local police.
I felt distinctly vulnerable, really. I thought, well, is something going to happen immediately? How shall I know? Do I go on trusting people? Do I lift up the phone?
Martin Vasey and Alison Loughlin and the many other victims of similar threats had no way of knowing they'd been targeted by an extremist group called Combat 18. Nor did they know it was already engaged in physical attacks on people it saw as its enemies.
Combat 18 could be described as an organisation participating in political terrorism, viewed in the context of threats of violence and carrying out that violence.
Combat 18 is thought to have about 70 active members. It takes its name from the first and eighth letters of the alphabet, the initials of Adolf Hitler.
It believes in organising itself on a cell structure, not a mass political movement, and it believes there is a certain amount of security in following a cell structure, so that infiltration by the police or security organisations is limited to the persons involved in a particular cell.
Combat 18's hit lists appear in its members-only bulletin called Red Watch. Copies obtained by World in Action reveal that scores of people have been targeted. They also reveal why. Combat 18 is a fanatical neo-Nazi group whose intended victims are usually Jews or its political opponents. Several MPs are singled out for harassment.
These publications have been called hit lists. Is that fair?
I think that's a very fair description, because what other interpretation can one place on a list of names and addresses circulated to members? It must be for the purpose of, at least, harassment.
And at worst?
And at worst, severe physical attack.
March the 27th at a bookshop in East London. The quiet of a normal Saturday is about to be shattered.
They were wearing hoods with slits showing only their eyes. They had carved and painted wooden clubs.
Freedom Press, a small radical publisher's for over 100 years, had become the latest victim of Combat 18. The cell carrying out the attack worked with clinical efficiency.
But within a couple of minutes, and this happened very quickly, within 2 or 3 minutes, they smashed anything to do with typesetting. There's a computer typesetting machine, and another machine, which is a laser jet printer. They smashed that with their clubs, and then went straight off out. Definitely, this was with military precision. Yes, these people knew what they were doing.
Before they left, the raiding party left a calling card. Above a door, they sprayed C-18. Until now, little has been known about Combat 18. Its Red Watch hit list was seen only by its own members. The rare copies which leaked out gave only a post office box address in America. But that address is a clue to the shadowy figure behind Combat 18. Greensboro, North Carolina, in the United States. In November 1979, right-wing fanatics attack a demonstration against the Ku Klux Klan. They produce guns and they open fire. They kill 5 people. It became known as the Greensboro Massacre. Pulling the triggers were members of several Ku Klux Klan and Nazi groups. One of their leaders, though he was not present at the shootings, was a veteran Nazi called Harold Covington. The American address given on C-18's Red Watch hit lists is Covington's own P.O. Box in North Carolina. Dixie Press is his publishing company, also based in North Carolina. Red Watch describes how any information about potential targets is to be sent to the Dixie Press address, and
our brothers in America will then redirect any correspondence back to our safe address here in England.
And in Red Watch, Combat 18 thanks Big H in North Carolina for his help. Tried before an all-white Southern jury, all the Greensboro gunmen were acquitted. But interviewed even as his men stood trial, Covington had no regrets about what had happened.
I do not give a happy damn about their human rights or anything else. They got what they deserved.
You show no remorse toward the families or the victims?
One shouldn't show remorse for stamping on a rattlesnake.
And even then, Covington was talking about a new approach for his followers.
We've got a whole new plan, a whole new method of operating that we're going to initiate. It's a response to the fact that the government has tried to kill us here 4 times in the past 18 months. And it involves putting the party on a semi-underground status, but it also involves a whole new tactical direction for the movement.
Harold Covington no longer appears in his stormtrooper's uniform, but he's still an active Nazi. And today he's putting into action his plan to build an underground Nazi movement. In his own newsletter, Resistance, he describes how he's setting up a network of cells across the world. One of those cells is Combat 18. Covington is much more than just Combat 18's postman. Last year, after shaving off his characteristic beard, he was staying secretly in Britain. Here, he linked up with British Nazis to set up Combat 18. Travelling on an Irish passport, obtained when he married an Irish woman, he spent last summer in this house in East London. When his cover was blown, he abandoned the house and fled. He hasn't been seen in public since. He was in Britain at exactly the time that Combat 18's campaign of death threats began.
It's very significant that Covington is involved. He's not just another loony right-winger attracted by the fantasy of Nazi uniforms or Ku Klux Klan. He's a man with a long history of involvement in violent activity. It gives them the experience of organizing on a clandestine basis. It gives them the experience of the use of violence and how to target your enemies, how to collect information on your enemies, which is what his organization was doing in America in the 70s. Covington is trying to build a clandestine neo-Nazi organization dedicated to violent activity as he did in America.
Earlier this year, one C-18 member broke ranks. We'll call him Simon. Alarmed at what he was getting into, he contacted World in Action. He told us what C-18 was set up to do and how it does it. To protect his identity, we've used an actor. But these are Simon's exact words.
Well, basically, we're talking about political terror. People on the far right have always said that too much time was spent talking about things and what was needed was action. When the opposition to the far right got organised, and there was a real call for it, and the people involved just decided to put something together and basically give the right-wing punters what they wanted, which is Red's heads being cracked.
And soon, heads were being cracked. World in Action has established that at least two serious gang attacks last year, where people were badly injured, were secretly planned and carried out by Combat 18. Tim Heppel was a senior member of the British National Party, Britain's biggest extreme right party, and worked at their headquarters. But the BNP didn't know he was an infiltrator, spying for their anti-fascist opponents. In February last year, he was recruited by C-18 to join an attack on peaceful anti-Nazi campaigners in East London.
We knew where they were going to be. We knew where they were going to meet because they put their posters up all around this area and also in South London. So we walked out of the pub, and the group that I was with was a skinhead group, about 15 of us. And as we saw the leafleters, as we approached them, there was a skip full of bricks and bottles, and we armed ourselves with the bricks and bottles and basically charged into them, and they didn't know we were going to hit them until the last minute.
I think they actually caught me before I actually made the floor, and there was quite a few around me, and when I eventually fell onto the mattress and onto the floor, and I saw this one lump of concrete that was being held in two hands coming down towards my face. I immediately turned away and tried to bury my head. Unfortunately, it hit me in the back of the head and split my head open. Later, I was told by the police officers that actually came and rescued me almost from the situation, that they had been throwing half house bricks at me while I was laying on the floor as well.
Police hadn't turned up. He might have been kicked so badly unconscious he might never have woken up. I mean, I saw his head all open and all blood coming out of the back of it. It was disgusting. And he was sort of like whimpering, you know. And also there was the shock because he didn't see it coming, you know, just straight on the back of his head.
I'm gonna tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bow to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us, this one thing I know. People of every colour marching side by side, marching across the fields where a million fascists died. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Take my union gun. Gonna end this world of slavery before this war is won. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Are you fascists about to lose? You fascists about to lose. You fascists about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascists are bound.
heart of London's Dockland, unmarked to passers-by, are these premises, the Metropolitan Police Public Order Training Centre. There's been close liaison between senior officers here and those at the picket lines. The result could be a new concept in policing, thus far alien to this country. Here, police practice firing plastic bullets, CS gas riot guns, and water cannon. The police deny training here is specifically geared to the coming winter, but they do say these weapons are an option in a very tight corner. The ideological battle between two men, Mr. Scargill and Mr. McGregor, is bringing to quiet English villages scenes more akin to Poland or Chile. Each man's vision, one shaped in Wyoming, America, the other saltly England, affords little common ground. If tonight's peace talks fail, with General Winter advancing, this transformation of Britain's political landscape will be well underway.
This is the story of a factory and some broken safety regulations. Acre Mill, Hebden Bridge, Yorkshire. The owners, Cape Asbestos, a big international company, closed it down last year. But Acre Mill won't easily be forgotten.
Would you work in an asbestos factory again?
I certainly shouldn't recommend it to anyone.
There are new regulations now, and the safety standards are said to be much better. Would that influence you at all?
Not really. No, not with what I've got.
What have you got?
Asbestosis. And I know about it too.
What's it feel like?
At the moment, grim.
My brother died. He had asbestos, and it caused cancer of the lung, and he died. That's just 12 months ago.
Where did he work?
He worked at Cape, same place as my husband.
As my wife mentioned, her brother, I mean, we're living on borrowed time, aren't we?
How do you mean, borrowed time?
Well, I think I'm living on borrowed time, actually, because it's building up in my chest all the time.
The asbestos industry was warned in 1930 by an official report that asbestos dust could cause an incurable lung disease, asbestosis. As a result, the government laid down the Asbestos Industry Regulations 1931, designed to prevent asbestosis by controlling dust. At Acre Mill, some of those regulations were not observed. Tonight, Cape's own men show what went on. Today, Acre Mill is empty. We asked to film inside, but Cape weren't able to help us. Nor, for legal reasons, could they appear on this programme.
This is the Cape Asbestos cricket team, 1956-57. There are 16 men on that photograph, and four of them contracted asbestosis. Mr. MacDonald, the chief engineer, myself at the far end here, Alf Rose and Dick Hutchinson. Dick died through it a couple of years ago.
Cape came to Acre Mill in 1939, 8 years after the regulations were brought in. Our evidence is that from 1946 right into the 1960s, some of those regulations were broken at the mill. To show how, we have reconstructed three departments at the factory. This lorry is part of our first reconstruction. We have tried to make all three reconstructions as precise as any reconstruction can be. They are filmed in other mills near Hebden Bridge. But we have not used real asbestos, because it could be dangerous to the people taking part. So the 300 sacks on this lorry contain a mixture of cotton waste, flour, fuller's earth and lime. In this program, we are not going to blame any individual member of Cape's management for what happened at Acre Mill. This story could be repeated anywhere where the deadliness of asbestos dust is not appreciated. All the men you will see in this film worked for Cape at Acre Mill. They will describe working conditions in specific parts of the mill at the periods when they themselves worked there.
What was the first department you worked in Capes?
I had to start in the warehouse.
What did you do?
That was unloading wagons or anything like that that brought the asbestos.
What kind of sacks were they?
Oh, SEM. What, you were terrible, right? Not to mean it was full of holes.
The Asbestos Industry Regulations, 1931.
Regulation 8B. All sacks used as containers for the transport of asbestos within the factory shall be constructed of impermeable material and shall be kept in good repair.
In other words, the sacks must not let dust through. Hessian does.
Was it ordinary hessian, or were they lined in some way?
Oh, no, they wasn't lined at all, no.
You're quite sure about that?
I'm positive. Oh, I see.
Hessian sacks were used and reused throughout Acre Mill. In the warehouse, Cape were also bound by Section 47(1) of the Factories Act 1937.
In every factory in which there is given off any dust likely to be injurious to persons employed, exhaust appliances shall be provided where the nature of the process makes it practical.
What was the ventilation like?
None.
None at all?
None at all.
You're quite sure of that?
I'm positive.
No fan?
No fan, no.
Do you feel that you as charge hand should have complained about the conditions?
We did complain. We complained many a time.
What happened?
Nothing in particular, only we were the lads were provided with hoods for carrying the asbestos sacks off the wagon to keep it from the back of the neck.
Hoods, but not...
And masks, of course.
Nothing that kept the dust completely away from their faces?
No. I've known lads on top of a stack break a window to let a certain amount of dust out.
How thick was the dust when they did that?
Well, I don't know how you measure dust, you know, but it were...
Fairly thick. Cape didn't install proper ventilation in the warehouse. They did provide the men throughout the factory with rubber face masks, older versions of the ones you see here. They were the best available, but in conditions like this, asbestos dust got in round the edges.
Which year did you leave Cape?
1948.
Have you worked in any asbestos factories since then?
No.
When did you first find that you had asbestosis?
About 3 weeks before Christmas, 1970.
It's 22 years after you left Cape.
Yes.
How did you find out?
Well, I started with short of breath, and I went down to the doctor's, and I told him about the short of breath. Then he examined me, and then he says, "Have you ever worked in asbestos?" I said, "Yes, I have." I said, "But it's 20 odd year back." And I started laughing then. And he says, "What are you laughing for?" I said, "Well, I can't point anything. I can't blame it at this stage." He says, "I'm the doctor." He says, "Not you." So I says, "Oh." I felt a fool then, like, and he says, "What did you work at asbestos?" I said, "Well, I worked at Cape Asbestos, at Acre Mill." He said, "What was your job?" I said, "On disintegrator."
Daddy was a bank robber, but he never hurt nobody. He just loved to live that way, and he loved to steal your money. Some is rich and some is poor, and that's the way the world is. But I don't believe in lying back and saying how bad your luck is. Daddy was a bank robber, but he never hurt nobody. He just loved to live that way, and he loved to steal your money. So we came to jazz it up. We never loved to shovel. Break your back to earn your pay, and don't forget to grovel. Daddy was a bank robber, but he never hurt nobody. He just loved to live that way, and he loved to steal your money. Imagine if all the boys in jail could get out now together. What do you think they'd want to say to us while we were being clever? Daddy was a bank robber, but he never hurt nobody. He just loved to live that way, and he loved to steal your money. Daddy was a bank robber, but he never hurt nobody. He just loved to live that way, and he loved to steal your money.
Children in the streets of Birkenhead. For them, the prospects are bleak. Last year, 6 out of 7 school leavers couldn't get a job. Many have turned to heroin as an escape. For others, young and old, coping with unemployment means living off what the rest of us throw away. They're among the 13,000 out of work in Birkenhead. People who feel their prospects of work are so poor, they're on the scrap heap. It wasn't always so. Birkenhead once thrived.
The Queen goes to Merseyside, there to give a royal send-off to the world's most modern aircraft carrier, the Ark Royal. 60,000 are at Camel Laird Shipyard at Birkenhead to welcome her.
May 1950, the then Queen Elizabeth visited Birkenhead. It was a celebration of the town's industrial might. Camel Lairds built Birkenhead, and in 1950 their shipyard employed 17,000 men.
I name this ship Ark Royal. May God protect her and all who sail in her.
But the 1950s turned out to be a high watermark for the Merseyside Yard. Shipbuilding went into decline, and so did the town it had created. Shipyards and docks, which once employed 30,000, now provide work for less than 2,000. Today, even those jobs are threatened. Closed factories and deserted docks are monuments to the town's decline. 1 person in 5 is without work, and in the poorest areas, it's thought as many as 60% are without jobs. Camel Lairds today. Only 2 projects remain in the yard, and there are no orders on the books. The destroyer HMS Edinburgh leaves for sea trials this week. An offshore rig for British Gas is due to leave soon after. And this summer, 1,000 men will finish too. Among the latest casualties is a foreman scaffolder who had charge of 50 men. Alan Dawson.
We worked approximately 200 foot up in the air. It was a good effort from the whole department to do it. Then, after the Southern Explorer went, we then had to stage out another rig, which again was a high job, and new techniques of staging, which we, the department done, myself and other foremen. And then, after doing all this, to do everything that Camel Lairds requested you to do, and the men within the department, to be just handed a letter one night and told to leave the yard by the end of the week is just incredible. My job is, it was a strenuous job. I had to do an awful lot of climbing. You know, I started to find it a bit hard, and I thought this was through lack of proper exercise, so I joined the gym in order to maintain a certain standard of fitness too, which I think was required by my job.
At the seaside in North Wales, Alan, his wife and 2 youngest daughters enjoy a week's holiday booked before the axe fell at Camel Lairds. Before he can afford another, Alan will have to find work. He knows from family experience how hard that is likely to be.
Okay. I've got a brother-in-law who's unemployed. I've got a brother who's unemployed. I've got a father-in-law who's unemployed. They can't find work. One of them's been unemployed for 4 years, has looked everywhere. He's even got a bike and has gone looking for work on his bike, but he can't find it anywhere.
Come on, Lucy. Come on, Randy, come
down. I think the only way I'm going to get a job as good as the one I had is to work abroad. I think it will affect my family life. I would miss the children. I've got 2.5-year-old and a 4-year-old and an 11-year-old. You know, I think I'd miss them, didn't you? Oh, then there's a doll. Well, there's a doll that's living on the breadline all the time. I can see us running out of money. We won't be able to pay the bills. We won't be able to do what we've been used to in the past years. And this will lead to tension and arguments. And, you know, we could end up splitting up, I suppose. If I was on the dole and I'd seen that my family were not being adequately dressed, adequately fed, given a decent standard of living, I would work on the side without people, without any hesitation whatsoever.
What are the drawbacks to doing that?
The drawbacks are if you get caught, you could probably get your dole stopped, or you could get sent to prison. But I think I am willing to take that chance because I am willing to work. They are defrauding me of the right to work.
4 years ago, Mickey was in the same position as Alan is today. At 30, he'd worked all his life in ship repair, winning promotion to charge hand and leading a team of riggers. He remembers the crisis which unemployment caused.
You know, I just couldn't believe it. I got the check on a Friday. Well, when I woke up Monday, I just couldn't believe he had nothing to do. So I just started going out, going to the pub, getting drunk in the afternoon. Every time I woke up, I just felt depressed all the time. You know, it's just walking around the old smoking. I'm getting out of here. And the first place I could go was the pub. I felt like the beer was my shield. Things just got that bad. That she threw me out, I just had to move out.
Dot had been married to Mickey for 8 years when the dole changed their life.
I couldn't stand it. He was drinking all the time and he was rowing all the time and down that it just started going downhill. You know, from when he came out of work, just steadily went downhill and that was it. I just couldn't stand it anymore. I used to pack up and go, say for about a week or two, and then I had to come back, you know, because of the kids, because nobody's going to put you up with 4 kids, are they? Just to get up in a bad mood, scream and shout at the kids, just rubbing my purse, because I'm a baby with that, or rub the electric meter, and I had to pay all the bills. I mean, as far as he was concerned, you know, all the bills were in my name, so he'd rob the money, but I'd still have to pay it.
How bad was it?
Terrible. I mean, I felt like running away, you know, without the kids.
As his redundancy money ran out, Mickey, still out of work, turned to crime to buy his drink.
Got me took to court 4 times. Got me put in jail once.
And was that when you decided things were going to change?
Not really. Because when I come out of jail, I was still doing the same. Until one day some fella said, "You're coming over the tip for an hour."
Bidston Moss Tip, Birkenhead. People come here to find clothes for their families, furniture for their homes, or scrap they can sell. We even found one man getting his food. This is the frontier between the haves and have-nots. The boundary between two Britons is marked by a row of rubbish skips. From here, lorries deliver the things society rejects to people who believe society has rejected them. 10 years ago, only a handful of routers visited the tip. Today, that handful has become 100.
I was on the tip for about half an hour, and now I'm going to come out. Couldn't take it. You know, you've got to wait by a skip and dive in. If you see anything, You know, just watching me.
You'll have to watch what you said.
But then I just gradually went over and over and over. Just got used to it.
What was the hardest part about doing it?
Oh, it's more or less you're degrading yourself going on there. You know, you're picking things up, which you'd never dream of doing if you was working or had the money to go out and buy it. You know, you just wouldn't do it.
Do you still think it's degrading?
Up to a certain extent, yeah, but there's nothing else you can do. It's either go over there, have a lap over there, sit over there for a few hours, or just go out and rub some pub again.
Come on, Michael, now! Yeah.
For Mickey, the tip provided a way of escaping from the pressures of unemployment which had wrecked his marriage. 4 years after their divorce, he and Dot remarried.
It all happened about 3 months ago. We just started coming back down about 3 months ago. Just started talking. Whenever I could, started taking her out. And I just said, should we get married again and try it again? She said, yeah. So we just went out and got married. And we're going to try again now.
Did going on the tip play a part in that?
Yeah.
All the best,
everyone.
Yay! Mind your bun, you nearly knocked your bun off.
Thanks,
Oh, it's helped me to pull myself together over there. Because it's very seldom I drink now. Very seldom. I might touch out on a bit of gold over there, or a bit of silver. I'll go and weigh that in. Which, you know, very seldom happens, like. But I'll go and weigh that in. Then with that money, I'll go up for a drink.
When the people of the country have forgotten how to disagree, the national economy is said to be okay. The wages that you get will help you to forget. Will you keep your ideologies or throw them all away when the system has you beaten? Even now you haven't eaten because you can't afford to eat or drink to keep your brain alive. Blame the system for the weather. Carry on as ever. You're going to work at Upper State and come back home at five. Talking about the human race, how they got them out in space, but it never stopped the wars. The whole of this humanity is based on greed and vanity. The ones who make decisions are the ones who make the laws. But you're still in this society, so what should make priority? Remain in the majority, you never really cared. Or cultivate the hate to annihilate the state. Are you prepared to die for your beliefs or just to die your air? You exist to a population who insist you're just a bunch of fakes. You cannot change the system till you change your own restrictions. Communication and conviction gotta kick until it breaks.
Anyway.
I haven't been to Vietnam for 3 years. The war, after all, is a bore, so why go back? What is there left to say? Surely we've seen it all on telly. But our boredom has not made the war go away, so I've come back for the final act. No blood, no atrocities. Just the rejection of the war by those sent here to fight it. Just the quiet mutiny of the greatest army in history. This is Snuffy, some 8 miles from the Cambodian border, in a wilderness of jungle and mud, controlled by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. Snuffy is a beleaguered fort, defended by the 1st Air Cavalry Division. The scene there looks so familiar, like a faded snapshot of another war we wish to forget half a century ago, with its trenches and mud and barbed wire and boredom and young men and their puppies. Snuffy is important because it's the end of the line for the grunts. They are the 18-year-old drafted kids, the national servicemen on whom the entire army depends. They are the ones to whom the buck is finally passed from the President and the Pentagon and the career men who catch colds in their air-conditioned command posts. Out of 400,000 American soldiers in Vietnam, only 80,000 fight, and almost all of them are grunts. The grunts in 1970 are a very different kind of American foot soldier. They are mostly from a world unknown to their commanders. They are the graduates of an American rebellion that stemmed from the war they have been sent here to fight. And quietly but massively, they have brought that rebellion with them here to Vietnam. For the grunts are unraveling the very fabric of the military. They are growing their hair, wearing love beads, smoking pot, flourishing the V-sign of peace. And some are refusing to fight. The young men you see in this film are not a selected griping minority. I've spoken to hundreds of young soldiers, and the rebellion they feel so deeply is everywhere.
To stop spread of communism. I don't want to see communism spread it all over the world. Nothing I can do about it. Just stay and do my time, which I'm going to do. Get out of Vietnam, go back to the world.
I couldn't see any purpose in the war back home. Mm-hmm. It never explained to me why we're actually here. And I really had nothing against these people. I want to kill them. And you go out in the woods and they'll shoot at you first. You'll see them, you know, they'll shoot you if they get the chance. You have to shoot at them first. It's really bad. I still don't know why I'm here. That's God's truth. 3 months and I don't know why I'm shooting these people.
Today is the day.
The grunts are the wheels of the Green Machine, the name they give the military. The Green Machine is comic book America with flesh on it.
Today is the day for you to let people...
A wonderland of heroes and slogans. In the Green Machine, a grunt doesn't seek out the enemy. He goes hunting for gooks. The Green Machine plays games, like Wandering Soul.
Wandering Soul is a tape that has been put out by the Psychological Operations Battalion and Benoit. It's used by the operating divisions and separate brigades to broadcast a rally appeal to the Viet Cong. The tape itself is a rather weird one, with the funeral dirge music in the background and a father talking to his children saying he's died on the battlefield and he's trying to encourage his comrades to rally and join the just cause.
The Vietnamese people worship the souls of their ancestors, but this wandering soul is very different. It was conceived in an echo chamber by the US Army and is broadcast from a helicopter over jungle where the gooks are supposed to be hiding.
We drop, I'd say, about 800,000 leaflets a day. We tell them what's happened to them in their battles. We killed 3 of your people yesterday, and they know it. We tell them also that you're going to be killed this, you know, into the future. You could be killed, and why? We ask them to desert their unit and what will happen to them once they rally, how they'll be well treated. Well, actually, it's been pretty slow. So far this month, we've had 5. Last month, we only had 1. The object of dispersing our leaflets by helicopters. They'll take a bunch by hand and throw them out most of the time. Occasionally, in trying to get a direct result of a PSYOPS mission, they'll take a whole carton, which you'll see, and just drop it right out, hoping to hit someone.
Let's have some fun.
You've got pride, and you're really proud of what you're doing, and proud of seeing what you have done in the past. And this division has lived on a proud heritage. MacArthur said it well. This division is first in almost everything.
General George Custer was in the cavalry, and now instead of rattling sabers, we have rippling rotor blades.
Lifers and grunts, the career men who command the rear, the kids who hold the front.
A lifer is a person that wants to make a career out of the Army, that they sit back in air-conditioned rooms and say, okay, you guys go out there and fight the war. We'll tell you where to go and how to do it. But all they do is sit back there and draw their combat pay for not doing nothing. We just sit back there on their butts.
A lifer is someone, that, to me, that stays in the Army 20 or 30 years and has... that's just his job. When you come in the Army and you're a grunt like us, well, we're just out in the boonies humping the big pack and all, fighting the Viet Cong and the NVA.
Who does the fighting, the grunts or the lifers?
The grunts. There are some lifers out there with us, but they don't see too much action on them.
Very few.
Lifers are always in the rear trying to run everything out in the field, and the grunts out there trying to do the best you can. Like the lifers is, say, like they're back here and like they say, go to this hill and this hill. They don't look at the terrain and everything and how rough it is and everything. And the grunt's the one that has to go through all the hell.
Grunt has to do the fighting.
Yes.
Now the trick is with wearing a suit like this is the same trick as living in America today, which is how do you come to terms with wealth and such a... In a world so filled with troubles, can you still have a sense of responsibility? No, I could never strip, for that would be cheap. I prefer to maintain my dignity as an American citizen. I will never strip. So I'll now try to wear this gold suit and sing a song of significance and try to have wealth come to terms with responsibility.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. Young land started growing, young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big farm. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, it's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun, tell me is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers, so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, it's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leader is screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore.